The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I thought this evening the topic could be a particular exploration of compassion, with the idea of leaving it as a question mark. How is it that we live a compassionate life? How do we express compassion? How do we respond to the world in compassion? And I think it's one of the profound topics. But in bringing that question mark to you, for you to consider, I'm going to do it in the form of a discussion of Buddhism and vegetarianism. Periodically people ask me about this, and so some people are interested in this topic. And there are a number of people who expect Buddhists to be vegetarian. Buddhism puts a tremendous emphasis on the first precept. It's the first precept of the five late precepts. Is kind of like the template or the principle behind all the other precepts. The first precept is not to cause harm. Sometimes translated as not to kill, but literally it means not to cause harm to breathing beings. So it's usually taken to be animate objects, animate beings. And so what does it mean to follow that precept, or what does it mean to be concerned about the compassion that is the rationale for even that precept? And since Buddhists are supposed to be, you know, not kill or not cause harm, it seems that it's pretty obvious that they shouldn't be involved in meat eating, since that somehow involves the killing of animals. But we find that most Buddhists are not strict vegetarians. In our tradition, the Theravada tradition, there seems to be a great admiration for vegetarianism, but it's not like a hard and fast thing. You don't find like this religious stricture that says, thou shalt be vegetarian. And in some other schools of Mahayana, like in some areas of Mahayana Buddhism, there are some pretty strict teachings about being vegetarian. But in our tradition, there's not. So what's going on, and how does that fit into the first precept? How does it fit into the tremendous emphasis on cultivating and living a compassionate life? So a little bit the background for at least our tradition, which goes back to the time of the Buddha. The Buddha had a cousin who apparently, the tradition treats him as kind of like the evil cousin, who was also a monk in the Buddha's order, but he tried to take over the order. He was kind of jealous of his cousin, I guess, and tried to find various ways to take over, power struggle. Even back then, there were such things. Even the Buddha had to deal with that. And one of the things that his cousin, Devadatta, did was since he couldn't quite take over the order, he created a schism and kind of peeled off a lot of the Buddhist monks to follow him. And he did it by trying to create a monastic order that was much purer than what the Buddha had organized. In India especially, the idea of being purity was very highly regarded, and whoever was purest got the most support and whatever. And so he had his new monks, his people, follow much stricter ascetic practices. Because the idea being, if you're really ascetic, then you're pure. And the Buddha was teaching the middle way between asceticism and indulgence. And so one of those rules that the Devadatta had was that the monks had to be vegetarian, not eat any meat. It was not unusual in India for that time. The Jains, a whole other spiritual tradition that was quite strong at the time of the Buddha, they were very strict vegetarians. They were very dedicated to the teachings of non-harming, ahimsa. And part of their understanding of that was not to kill anything at all, and not to eat meat was part of their following that kind of teaching. So it was not unusual. So Devadatta made this requirement of his people, and the Buddha then was under some pressure, I guess, to institute such a rule. And he said, no, we're not going to do that. And he said, there are three conditions upon which a monastic may not eat meat. Actually, let's say four, but three my primary ones. One is that it's called, a monastic is only allowed to eat meat if the meat is pure in three respects. And it's pure if the monastic has not seen, heard, or suspected that the meat, that the animal was killed so they could have meat. So if you've seen or heard or suspect that the animal was killed specifically for you, if you're a monastic, then you can't eat it. The fourth thing, which is kind of more minor, but it's still there, is that monastics apparently are not allowed to eat elephants, horses, lions, tigers, and snakes. So, but otherwise, it's okay. I don't know what was going on back then, but those particular animals. But so why only limit the monastics, why this kind of rule that you can the only prohibition is against eating animals that have been killed for you? So the monastic order in Buddhism, the early tradition, they would go out every day with their alms bowl, a bowl that was probably about twice as big as this bell that we have here, and they'd walk around the village or walking around the countryside, and people would see that there were monastics with what's a begging bowl, an alms bowl, and people would drop food in it. Monastics are not allowed to keep food overnight. They're not allowed to make their own food, cook for themselves. They're not allowed to go and pick, they're not allowed to farm. They have to completely rely on the food that's donated to them, otherwise they don't eat. And so every day, because they don't store it overnight, they have to get rid of it at 12 o'clock, they have to go with this empty bowl. And if people feed them, then they eat. If people don't, they don't eat that day. And there's lots of stories of monastics that go hungry for the day because no one made any offerings. And so they go through the villages with this bowl, and out of the goodness of people's hearts, they want to support the monastics, want to help them and support their lives and whatever, people who are normally cooking their food will, for their own family, their own household, will see the monastic walking down the road. And they'll come out and say, here, have some of my food. Have some of the dish that I'm making for my family. Some of the food that we have here. And if people were cooking meat, meat would be part of what they had in their home, part of what they were cooking for themselves, and so they'd offer some of their own food. And it's a generous act. And it's a beautiful thing for someone to want to support someone else who's doing a spiritual path, trying to liberate themselves, awaken themselves. It's a beautiful thing to be a monastic. So here there's a layperson in the goodness of their heart is coming forth with this beautiful offering of food. Should the monastic then say, mm-mm, I think, let me see, oh, there's meat there, I can't take that, forget that. That would make the layperson not only feel lousy, feel bad, but it would kind of sever the benefits, the joy of that generosity, the benefits of them being generous. It would kind of feel not very clean or very good to do that. The animal was not, because they were cooking it for themselves, for their family, they were not, the animal wasn't killed for the monastic. And after the animal is killed, it's no longer an animal, it's meat. So then the monastic receives that and is grateful to be fed. And so it goes. So that's how the system is set up. So in that kind of context, you maybe understand why the Buddha said, didn't want to prohibit his monastics from eating meat. Now, it isn't that, in a sense, they're compassionate, the monastics are compassionate for the donor, for the welfare of the donor, the generosity of the donor, they want to honor that. Because the animal wasn't killed for them, they're not involved in the question of life and death. They might have a lot of compassion for the animal, but they're not, engaged and involved directly in that you know, that life and death issue. And so again, they're, you know, it's not really their, you know, their business in a sense. So that's how it is for the monastics. So what about for lay people? What about for lay Buddhists? So the very interesting thing about lay Buddhists is that it's in my reading of the, if you still stay in the time of the Buddha, so I read the ancient literature, the ancient scriptures of the from the time of the Buddha, it didn't seem that the Buddha felt it was really his place very often to tell lay people what to do. Monastics were kind of like his close disciples. They'd done something very dramatic, you know, done an ordination into a particular kind of very powerful training, religious training. And they kind of made a certain kind of commitment to the Buddha to train under him. Lay people generally didn't do that. They might have gone for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, but they weren't kind of in the same kind of, say, here, you're my teacher, tell me what to do. So the Buddha seemed, as far as I can tell, somewhat reticent to tell lay people how they should live their life. Because, you know, there's no obligation in Buddhism. There's not like we don't have a God who sits above us all, who's, you know, says thou shalt in any kind of way. The guidance for moral action in Buddhism is not some kind of commandments, but it really is in our own hearts. Each individual heart has to understand the principles and have a sensitivity, the principles of compassion, the sensitivity of compassion, of empathy, and find their own way. And it wasn't the Buddha's place to judge what other people do. If someone eats meat, if someone does anything, that's their business. You know, the Buddha is not in the business of judging people or telling people what to do. And people do all kinds of unusual things in the world. And, you know, to this day, people do unusual things. And, you know, it's like, it's not like our business to go and judge each other or other people in other places in the world for how they, what they do. And you know, so anyway, he didn't feel like it was his place, right? So he didn't really give strong ethical teaching in terms of, you know, particular things, how lay people should live their lives. He did say, you know, it's really good if you didn't kill, if you didn't steal, if you didn't lie, and didn't engage in improper sexuality and harmful sexuality, don't engage in intoxicants. But, you know, that was kind of very general, how you lived that and how well you lived it and how you interpret that. The Buddha kind of didn't have much to say. So, you know, if my interpretation here is accurate, you know, it wasn't his place to tell people you should be a vegetarian. So, you know, we don't have that kind of teaching, you know, lay Buddhists should be vegetarian. What it means, which I think is quite beautiful, is it's left to us. In a way, Buddhism constantly says it's left to you. You have to decide. You have to find your way. There's the principle of if you want to be liberated, if you want to be free of your suffering, it's really helpful to follow certain useful tools, certain ways of living. But it isn't like thou, you have to live this way. It's more like if what you want is to learn, like for example, if you want to learn French, you better study French. If you want to become liberated, you better study that way of life that supports liberation. There's no obligation to get liberated. You're not like, you know, so it's kind of left to us. How do we find our way? How do we negotiate our way? To look to Buddhism for a strict rule, and to, you know, about vegetarianism or eating, I think is to misunderstand what Buddhism is trying to teach us. Buddhism is not meant to be a rule-based religion that now I can be a good Buddhist because I followed all these rules and therefore that's how it is. But rather, what I like to believe is to be a Buddhist is to have concern about liberation, the freedom from liberation from suffering, and concern with compassion. To have that both those motivations and priorities in one's heart. And then with those priorities and with those as a guidance, each person has to find their own way in each situation. How do we live that? How do we express that? Because Buddhism doesn't lay down this law. This is how it has to be. So with vegetarianism, we don't get this kind of, at least in our tradition, this very strict, that thou shalt be a vegetarian. At the same time, in many, many Theravadan countries, the lay people admire people who are vegetarian because there's kind of a natural connection between, seeming connection between being compassionate and concerned for animals and not eating them. Here in the West, in particular, Western lay Buddhists will often give monastics, almost always, not always, but generally give their monastic, when they make offerings, vegetarian food. It just kind of seems like that's what you should do. Here at IMC, when we have potlucks, we ask that people bring vegetarian food, not serve meat. It just seems like that seems right to us. It seems kind of odd to have meat in a place like this. Occasionally someone doesn't know that we asked for that, and they come with the meat, they lay it out on the table here at potluck. And I think if they do that, we shouldn't say anything. We should just let it be there. And those people who are okay with eating meat, it would be good to receive it and make them feel comfortable and appreciated for what they offer. And maybe the following month they'll get the news. We'd rather not have that here. So how does that individual then negotiate this issue? How do we follow it? Again, one of the suggestions in Buddhism is, teachings is that to consider yourself superior to others is a form of suffering for you. So to hold yourself as being a vegetarian and therefore better than someone or purer than someone else, that's just suffering. That's not useful. And you see that the number of people who are vegetarians hold themselves that way against others. So Buddhism, says, look at yourself and look at what you're attached to, and if you're engaged in that kind of activity, that kind of way of thinking, try to free yourself from it. Some people think that if you're a vegetarian, you're somehow spiritually pure. And that also, the Buddha says, that's kind of like magical thinking. And you don't become spiritually pure just by what you eat. You become spiritually pure in Buddhism by what's in your heart, not what's in your stomach. And so if your heart is motivated by compassion and kindness and generosity and those things, then it's a pure heart. But if you can eat all the vegetables in the world and be greedy and hate people and break all the other precepts, and the vegetarianism is not going to help you. So Buddhism tends to focus on the heart, not the stomach. Now, when I was in Burma, I was a monk there. I was practicing there for a long time. I was in a very large monastery, and there were I don't know how many, but hundreds of monks there and nuns, lots and lots. And we would go for our meal every once a day, our main meal, and it'd all be laid out there, and they ate a lot of meat. There was a lot of pork. And mostly I avoided all the meat, but tried the best I can to avoid it. They had a fish chowder that I would eat. But after being kind of malnourished, because the food wasn't very good, I started eating chicken and the fish for the first time I'd been a vegetarian pretty strictly for about, I guess, over 10 years by that time. For a part of that time, I was a vegan. And then I found myself kind of ending my strict vegetarian era in a Buddhist monastery in Burma. It was, a little odd, I thought. But I just felt like I got to get some protein in here. And a year before that, I was in a monastery in Japan, a Zen monastery. And there the diet was even worse, and there wasn't any meat, really, very little meat. I mean, there was, that's this whole story, but there they, there I was also getting malnourished, and I didn't recognize the signs, but this other monk pulled me aside one day and said, "Gil, I noticed that after the evening meditation, before going to bed, you go to the kitchen and raid the cookie jar, the cookie, they had these candies, had all these Japanese special candy, bean candies, and they had a lot of them. People donated to the monastery, so it was a surplus of them. And I would go there, and I don't have much of a sweet tooth. It's not like my thing to eat sugar and a lot and stuff. But I would go there and stuff myself with all this sweet. And he came and said, "Gil, I noticed this about you, and one of the signs of protein deficiency is a sweet tooth." And so what I did was I jumped over the monastery wall, snuck out, and went to a local grocery store and bought powdered baby's milk. And then every day at lunch, I would mix my concoction and drink that, and then I stopped craving sugar. So that was in Japan. So a year later, I was in Burma, and there was I couldn't go jump over the wall and get powdered milk. So then I started eating chicken. Sorry to go on and on. But the point I was going to say was that eventually I went to our teacher, Upandita, and I said to him, look, there are hundreds and hundreds of monks here. And you guys serve all this pork. It's like one of the main pieces of the meal was pork. And usually swimming in oil. Everything was swimming in oil. It's really amazing. We would take the vegetables and, you know, out of this, you know, out of this bowl of oil and shake out of the oil and then pat it on the napkins. And it was just amazing, the diet. And so we would... So I went to the teacher, the abbot, and said, look, you know, in America we have this idea of the law of supply and demand. And you have so many monks here, so many monastics here, that, the butchers in town, they know who's coming to buy the meat. The monks don't buy the meat, but the lay people who run the monastery go into the market and buy all this pork. So I said, look, you know, don't tell me this, you know, supply and demand thing, right? You provide, you're the demand, so they're providing the supply. So I'm sure they're calculating, they go out and they kill these pigs. So, you know, because you can't have all these thousands of monks without affecting the supply and demand thing. And he feigned, he didn't have a clue what I was saying. But many, many years later, I read that his teacher, in a book, wrote basically the same thing, and recommending that monks not eat meat, because he said it was really hard for monks to be sure that the meat, the animal, is not killed for them. They can't even suspect the animal's been killed. And so that abbot's teacher said, best that monks don't eat meat, because they want to be sure that... So anyway, he didn't express any understanding of the issue with me. So what do we do here in this country? You know, how do we relate to this? So one is, I don't know what you'll do, but I know that I prefer not to eat meat. Sometimes now I'll eat fish and chicken. I try not to eat anything else, any, you know, beef or stuff like that. That just seems too much. But occasionally, some beef meal or some meat meal will appear in front of me. Like if I forget to order the vegetarian meal on the airplane, and they serve me something, or if I'm at someone's house and they don't know that I prefer being a vegetarian, and somehow they go to all this trouble to make something and they put it in front of me, and I'm not going to say, you know, please don't, or, you know, thanks for all the hard work, but I can't eat this. So then I'll eat it, you know, and that seems like the right thing to do. But what about the animals? What about all the animals that not only get killed, but many animals who live in quite inhumane situations? What is our relationship to them? Do we live oblivious of how they live? Even if we eat meat, do we say that's out of sight, out of mind, that nothing to do with me, that's someone else's karma, or they're just animals, it doesn't really matter, or I'm busy, I don't think about that. What do we think about the world that extends beyond us, that we're connected to but we don't see? And there's a very big, wide world that we're connected to, that we have impact on. And one of the things that's coming out that many people feel now strongly about, the world, the environmental issues in the world, is how much how much nowadays. Maybe we can't make big changes, but a lot of people making small changes makes a difference. And so how about all these animals, these animal farms where they live in terrible conditions in cages? And what we consume and what we live, does it have an impact on that? And what does our heart tell us about our relationship to that? One of the attitudes I had about eating meat, still have it in a sense, is... am I willing to kill the cow? Am I willing to kill the chicken? If I'm going to eat it, shouldn't I be willing? And if, you know, would you be willing to go to a slaughterhouse and put the slaughter gun to the and to the right between the eyes of the cow, and you know, look the cow in the eye and say, you know, you're for dinner. Some people would, and some people find that it just somehow doesn't compute in the heart. It just can't do it. Do we do that exercise of imagination when we're not involved directly, or does it really someone else, is, you know, that someone else is doing? In some countries, in Theravadan countries in Asia, it's understood that killing animals is very bad karma. So Buddhists don't want to do it. And so the butchers all are belong to a different religion. And so the Buddhists will go to the butcher and buy the meat, but, you know, that's the butcher's karma, that they killed it. That seems kind of odd, doesn't it? To me it seems kind of strange. It seems like you're still participating in it. Maybe it's not, karma is not as bad as the butcher, but still it seems, doesn't seem quite ethical to me to... It seems even somehow worse to let someone else do all your dirty work intentionally. So how is it for us? And how do we consider the extended world? Does it have, is it something we're interested in? Or is it nothing to do with compassion for us? Because compassion is maybe only close in. Or does it feel like an imposition to have to think about things that are just so far away? And is it an imposition to be limited from what we want and our desires and all that? How do we grapple with this question of compassion and the expression of it? So one of the things I wanted to convey today is that the Buddhist tradition has, because of historical reasons, doesn't come down with strong teachings about vegetarianism. To some degree, because lay people look to monastics as the models of how to live a spiritual life, because the monastics cannot be vegetarian, there's an assumption that it's okay for lay people to be vegetarian. However, the monastics are not allowed to be vegetarian, but lay people are. So in a sense, we have greater freedom than the monastics to choose our diet and how we live our life. We go to the stores and we can choose what we buy. So we have a whole different set of considerations that lay people need to have. The monastics don't. Monastics don't buy their food. We do. So how do we consider that? And what are the choices we make? What are the trade-offs? You know, some people feel that it's unfortunate to kill an animal, but I need it for my health. I count too, don't I? And so there's kind of a trade-off, and people kind of are weighing the trade-off, and that's how some people do it. So the second thing I wanted to convey was the question, the issue of not the answer, should you or shouldn't be vegetarian, but rather I think it's really beautiful that someone would ask the question, that someone would be concerned, what is the right thing to do, or what's the compassionate thing to do here, to grapple with it, even if you're not satisfied with your answer. The fact that someone would grapple and be concerned about that, I think is a beautiful thing. I wish more people in the world would grapple with these questions. Grapple with questions of life and death. So those are my thoughts. And what do you think? Do you have any comments, questions that you'd like to make? Yes.
Well, this is kind of a silly question, but do you know if Buddha was ever asked about this question himself, by a lay person, whether there were any, what the karmic consequences of any, if any, of eating meat?
As far as I know, he was never asked that. He certainly said there were karmic consequences of killing animals.
Yeah.
So one of the forms of wrong livelihood, because it's karma so bad, is being a butcher. Butcher meaning someone who kills the animal. But otherwise, he was never asked, as far as I know.
I remember one... story the Dalai Lama told about when he attempted to be a vegetarian. The story was he was at a monastery and they were cooking him a meal and they served chicken for the meal, and he ate the chicken because the Tibetans typically, of course, they eat meat. It's very difficult not to. And then after the meal, he saw a bunch of chickens running around in the yard, and he said, boy, there must be one less chicken. He didn't feel quite right about that because he realized that there wasn't a grocery store, so that's where they got the chicken. And so But he, for health reasons, was then advised by his doctors, that's what I heard, that he should eat some. But then he said, oh, well, I have the greatest admiration for people who are able to be vegetarian. And I think he even changed the diet in the monasteries where possible to be vegetarian.
Beautiful. The monastics have a lot of rules. And some of the rules have to do about eating, like how you eat. And one of the rules, for example, is you have this alms bowl and you put all your food in the one bowl, all your dishes. So dessert, salad, soup, the entree, you know, everything goes in this one bowl. And then one of the rules is you're not supposed to discriminate when you eat. You're not supposed to like eat all the dessert first, or or you know save something for the end. Or, you know, you're supposed to just dip your spoon in there and eat whatever comes out. You know, and because eating is for sustenance. Eating is for the care and welfare of your body, not for beautification, not for pleasure. Just for the getting by in a nice way. For the monastics. So you're not supposed to kind of, you know, when it's in the bowl, you're not supposed to pick and choose, you're not supposed to. Now, but one of the really great rules is you're not allowed to look into the bowl of your neighboring monk to see how he's doing, whether he's following that rule or not. And I think that's beautiful. You don't look in the neighbor monk's bowl. You know, you don't go around looking at your neighbor's house and say, you know, or your friend, even if they eat meat, you know. You know, I don't think it's a good thing to go and make people feel bad about themselves or judge them. And, you know, let them do what they do. But again, the point is to look in our own heart.
So I'm wondering if you might say more about vegetarianism as elitism.
Elitism
historically with the interdependency of the Sangha and the lay community, and the Brahmins being the only strict vegetarians, and then contemporarily as a massive trap to think your practice is supposed to look like something.
Well, you said it. I mean, I don't know if I could say it then. But I said earlier in the talk that, you know, one of the hindrances is to consider yourself superior, which, you know, to hold yourself as better than everybody else because you're vegetarian. But there's suffering involved in that. But it wasn't just the Brahmins who were vegetarian. There was also the Jains were vegetarian. So, you know, perhaps the Buddha was trying to break some of those caste barriers too by refusing.
So the most beautiful part of it for me, but I could just be remembering it incorrectly, is that if you cut away support from the lay community, any faction of it, then you'd have a more isolated, potentially more elitist, non-interdependent sangha, where they're, I mean, beyond food, shelter, security, medicines. The foresight was for that
to be into
interplay.
It. So you're saying that if the monastics were vegetarian, then there are certain families, certain populations who wouldn't then participate because they eat meat. And so then the monastics wouldn't be integrated into the widest possible part of the society. There'd be barriers between the connection, that food connection between the monastics and the... Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So by not having that kind of limitation, you can go anywhere. You can receive anybody's donation and support. I know that some of the Western monastics, some of the Westerners who are monks and nuns, some of them strongly would prefer to be vegetarians, but they can't say it. You know, but they would prefer that way. Yeah.
One of the things that's very upsetting for me is to know that meat was bought and then not eaten, that it was thrown out as garbage. And that is very upsetting for me.
Because it's disrespectful to that life also.
That's right. Mm. Yeah. So I will make a point of eating all the meat in our house right before it's being thrown out.
Yes.
I was wondering how you felt physically when you began eating meat. I asked that because I know that after a long retreat, when it's vegetarian, I usually feel pretty good. Of course, there's lots more stuff going on than the diet, but I keep always think, oh, I should eat more vegetarian kind of diet. But I just wondered, when going the other direction, how did you feel physically?
Yeah, I was curious at myself when I finally started eating some meat. I said I don't really eat. I try not to eat beef, but at some point I got kind of curious, and I hadn't eaten for a long time. It's a little bit of chicken, but I wasn't for a long time, 10, 12, 15 years, I don't know how long. And so I tried eating a hamburger. And I thought, what's this going to do to me? Am I going to get sick in my stomach? Don't have the digestive juices anymore to deal with this? And nothing happened. I didn't feel bad. I didn't feel good. You know, just like... That's how it was for me, but I don't know how it is for others, but I never noticed any difference one way or the other for me.
I wanted to let you know I appreciate this talk. I've been trying to navigate this for the last year or so. My husband is from Nebraska, meat and potatoes all the way. I have two small boys, and so it's kind of hard to navigate that. But I've been kind of been finding my own path and way to do that at home, but I'd kind of come to the point, to the realization that I would never be a strict vegetarian because I come from a family and a culture where food is very strongly equated with not only hospitality but love. Like this is, and I could never ever picture a scenario where I would say no to something that one of my aunts would put in front of me. Mm-hmm. But so I just wanted to say I appreciate that, and I kind of felt like I was falling short somehow, but I had also made that decision that's just going to be where I fell. So thank you.
I have two sons at home. One who is a very strict vegetarian. He's from a very young age, he found that way himself. We don't have too much meat at home, but he's like won't anything. And the other is a complete carnivore. if he had his choice, he'd eat meat all the time. And so the one who's, would prefer to be a carnivore, I don't feel like it's my place to tell him he should be vegetarian. That's I don't know why he's making that choice. That's his choice. And so, like, if we go to a restaurant, he'll order a hamburger. And I guess I'm paying for it. Let people do their own choice this way.
I was vegan for quite a while, and I'm not vegan anymore because I add fish oil for health reasons. But I just wanted to say that it never made me feel pure or superior in any way, for a very simple reason that because of modern agricultural practices are what they are, thousands of smaller creatures like birds and rodents die during harvest of things like grains especially, but even vegetables. So actually I think that eating meat, you might be responsible for less death and suffering than eating grains. And for a loaf of bread, maybe more creatures perished than for something, like for hamburger, for instance. It's just something to keep in mind, I think.
Here's an interesting story. Some of you who are old enough, how many of you remember Francis Morlepe?
Somebody
died for a small planet. And she wrote a book in the early 70s, I think, mid-70s, called Died for a Small Planet, where she was one of the first people at least to popularize the idea that meat eating was environmentally costly, and that eating grains it was a much more efficient way. You use less water, less land, less fertilizer, less all kinds of resources. And it's quite the difference between a pound of meat, protein from meat, and a pound of protein from soybeans or something else is quite dramatically the difference. And resources that are used, and as water becomes scarcer, as fertilizers become bigger issue, you know, and the pollution of it, and all these, you know, the oil that goes into farming. So the world would have plenty of food if people stopped eating meat, because all that grain could be used in much more efficient ways. So she popularized that idea, and she had this cookbook called The Diet for a Small Planet. So I was going to school at UC Davis. I was a vegetarian. All my friends were vegetarians, and we were alternative agricultural activists on campus. I was studying agriculture and organic farming. And we were doing all this activist stuff on campus to promote organic farming and small-scale farming, alternative farming, all kinds of things. And so we had this lecture series that we organized as students, and we invited Frances Morlappe to come and give a talk. And she was quite famous back then, so we had to rent this huge auditorium, and the biggest auditorium on campus, and all these people came. It was a big event. But before the event, we had a potluck. And we invited her to the potluck. Everyone was going to come. And so we all came, all our students, we all came with the vegetarian dishes. And Frances Morlappe showed up with rabbit meat. And we kind of like looked at her and said, "What? How could you?" And she said, "This is a rabbit I raised myself on the scraps from my kitchen. And that's a very efficient way, again, an environmental way, of having meat, because that's going to waste anyway. It's better than composting it, is to have it, you know, recycled through an animal." And so, you know, she was not interested in the ethics of killing. She was interested in the ethics of resource use. And she thought it was better to use resources that way. So that was a great moment. We all expected her to be here to be vegetarian, and she showed up with the rabbit meat. And I became a vegan for a while, and before I even knew what the word was, one of the reasons was I lived for 6 months when I was 20, 21, on a dairy farm, a small dairy farm in rural Norway. And from there I learned that in order for a cow to make milk, I mean, I never thought about this, maybe so all of you guys knew that. Sounds silly that I wouldn't know this, but in order for a cow to make milk, it has to have calves. And it doesn't just then produce milk for years and years and years based on one calf. At some point, it stops producing milk after a year and a half or something, a year or something. And so for the cow to keep making milk, it has to keep giving birth to calves. Now, half the calves are bulls. And the life expectancy of a bull in Norway was a year and a half, because that's how long it took to fatten them up before they got slaughtered for meat. So I saw that on the farm, and I said, wow, my drinking the milk puts me right into that industry that involves killing cows. Bulls don't go to glorious retirement in early age, and, you know, in some pasture. And I didn't feel comfortable being part of that whole cycle of killing that the milk required. So then for a while, I just wouldn't touch any dairy products. And since then, I've now started eating dairy. And I don't know if I'm better off ethically or not, but whether it says something about what it says about me, that I've no longer have that strong feeling about it. Maybe it's because of the distance from the farm that I have that now. So last thing I'll say is that it's still a question mark for me, this issue. I don't feel like I have it resolved. I don't feel like I've come to the best possible solution about what to eat in terms of dairy products or meat or whatever. But how I've come to it is not because of a lack of a lot of thought and consideration and care. It just maybe I don't have the final word yet for myself. I'm still in process with it. But I think it's beautiful to grapple. And some of you maybe have already come to a decision and know pretty clearly how you are with it. And some of you maybe can still be nice to question it. And what I encourage you, if you question it, is don't question yourself. Question it from the point of view of guilt and shame. But really question it from the point of view of what's most beautiful in your heart. question from the point of view of whatever compassion, wisdom, love you have for everyone, including yourself and the whole world. Let that be the source of your questioning, your exploration. Feeling guilt and shame is a waste of resources. So I hope this was interesting and enough, and thank you very much.